Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Andy Kerr. He's the czar of the Larch Company, www.andykerr.net, K-E-R-R.net, and consults on environmental and conservation issues. The Larch Company is a for-profit, non-membership conservation organization that represents the interests of humans yet born and species that cannot talk. Kerr started his professional conservation career during the Ford administration. And by the way, I just want to say that Andy Kerr has been one of my heroes for decades. Anyway, he's best known for his two decades with Oregon Wild, the then Oregon Natural Resources Council, the organization best known for having brought you the Northern Spotted Owl. Kerr began his conservation career during the Ford administration. Through 2019, he's been closely involved with the establishment or expansion of 47 wilderness areas and 57 wild and scenic rivers, 13 congressionally legislated special management areas, 15 Oregon scenic waterways, and one proclaimed national monument and later expanded. He has testified before Congress congressional committees on several occasions. So first off, thank you for your work in the world. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Happy to be here, Derek.
So your and I current discussion really began with the possibility or the proposal for a new national park. Can you talk a little bit about the proposal, and then talk more broadly about the ecology of the region?
Sure. I mean, I hesitate to call it a proposal at this point. It's more of a notion. It's a large radical thought, meaning fundamental, different. But it's the idea is that we need more national parks, and where should we have them and what should they represent and protect and things like that. And, you know, many decades ago, I first went to Shenandoah National Park, a national park in the East established in the 1920s by the National Park Service, who said, you know, there's going to be a lot of people living near Washington, D.C. in the future, and we need a national park. But there aren't any national parks at that time, and there wasn't public domain land like the massive Bureau of Land Management and National Forests of the West, where the first national parks were carved out of. So the Commonwealth of Virginia acquired the land, including using eminent domain and evicting several hundred people, if not 1,000 or more people, because this land had been logged off, plowed up, grazed out, mined over. You know, it was pretty hammered. And the mission of the Park Service said, we're going to invite nature back. And that's what they did. And today, most of the park is designated as part of the National Wilderness Preservation System. So it wasn't pristine when it became a national park, but it is very natural and self-functioning now. So, you know, I was aware of that story. And then in the West, most of my work has been on conserving public lands that are already primarily in federal ownership. But there's this part of Oregon, the Oregon Coast Range, which ranges from the Columbia River to, geologically speaking, about the middle fork of the Coquille River. And then that's sandstone, siltstone, and it's a rainforest, and it's heavily logged for the most part. Not much mature and old growth forest left in the whole ecoregion. There are significant amounts of mature and old growth forest on the Siuslaw National Forest and on Bureau of Land Management holdings scattered throughout the region. But most of it's been logged on private land, some of it two or three times. And in this area that I'm proposing in Clatsop and Tillamook counties primarily, is in the North Oregon Coast Range. It was mostly private, is mostly private, a little bit of Bureau of Land Management for the federal government, and some state forests, the Tillamook and Clatsop State Forests. These are lands that were logged by private industry. They were considered worthless, and they were let go for taxes. They didn't pay the taxes. The counties took them for taxes that weren't paid, and the county gave them over to the state of Oregon, who has managed them. And there's now a big conflict over those lands, of how much to log for timber versus species conservation, whether specific salmon or northern spotted owls or marbled merlets or Pacific fishers or the coastal marten, and oh, there's all kinds of species of concern because there are many species in this region that depend on older, real, mature old growth forests. And with the standard industrial timberland, a rotation of a 40-year-old stand of trees that's clear cut again and planted with one species back, Douglas fir, and they're evenly spaced, they're even heights, they're sprayed with herbicides to keep the brush down so the conifer trees can grow. They're maybe thinned once and then they're cut again in 40 years. It's closer to a cornfield ecologically than to a forest. So we need real older forests again in large scale in the north, in the Coast Range of Oregon. And here's a place that could be a national park, but it's a long-term goal because when you look at it now, there's some very pretty forests on the state forest. The private lands are intensively hammered. So why go here? It's what was and what could be more than what is. These lands, industry lands, are particularly hammered. But I'll tell you a story. Back in the 1970s, I was a young environmentalist, and it was we'd gotten into some meetings, discussions with the timber industry, and we were going around doing field trips, and we were in this area, and on a particular watershed called Coochie Creek. And we got back to the hotel and we're in the bar. And fortunately, the industry guys had a big expense account. So we were living and drinking it up on their dime. And this timber guy, he said, and this was the 1970s, and he said, if we hadn't logged, we knew in the 1950s, if we didn't log it then, it would be a national park by now. So what he was admitting is that these were magnificent old growth forests, hundreds and hundreds of years old. The frequency of fire, because it is basically a rainforest, is very low. And these were massive stores of carbon, massive refuges of, it wasn't even a refuge, it just was biodiversity. These old growth forests would produce magnificent water, magnificent wildlife habitat, magnificent scenery if you were there to look. And they were the most productive forest lands in the world. These forests, there were none larger. There, in terms of biomass, the amount of the carbon, the amount of wood, the amount of board feet, you can measure it in different ways, but it's basically the living and dead material of life is stored in trees and parts of trees that the were there and they were lost. The We had fights in the 70s and in the 50s about the redwoods and the relics of the redwoods and other things, and but the most massive forests, they were logged off by the 1950s, primarily. And so now the fight is over what to get back. And so proposing a national park is visionary. Pardon the dog. Rain, go on. Go on. Run it up now. Come on. Go. Thought I had them corralled and I didn't. So these forests were massive and magnificent, and they can be again. Not in your day, not in my day, but it'll take hundreds of years. And because it's going to take so long, we should start right away. So how to do that? Well, a notion has to become a proposal and a campaign and an effort. And it often takes decades to get a new national park or a wilderness area or what have you. And so it's going to take time, but we need to start talking about it. And in conservation, public lands conservation, you create your own reality. If you start and you go, boy, you what are my chances? And you rationally look at it, you go, not a chance in hell. I'm not going to try. But fortunately, the cause is important, and we can be naive or stubborn or a combination thereof, and we just say, well, we're going to try. So I'm proposing that we try to establish a large multi-hundred thousand acre national park based initially on the Tillamook and Clatsop State Forest and massive amounts of private timberlands. And those lands are always for sale at a price. And if we want to talk about taking carbon out of the air, and we need to because we put so much carbon dioxide into the air, it's not a matter, even if we got rid of all of our fossil fuel emissions, we still have too much carbon in the air. That carbon, the most efficient carbon-sucking machine out of the air is a tree, and lots of trees, and not plantations of trees, but real old forests that store this carbon essentially indefinitely. So what would it do for salmon? It would help bring back the salmon from relic endangered runs to bountiful runs. What would it do for northern spotted owl and the marbled murrelet that need old growth forests? It would help a lot. So there's multiple benefits, but it's got to become real. It's not now, but it's a good idea, and we ought to work on it.
So there's a couple directions I want to go. One of them, very briefly, is, you know, we always hear about the 40-year rotation for Doug firs. Can you talk very briefly about the normal life of a Doug fir? So, I mean, do Doug firs normally live 60 years, 70 years?
It depends. Normal, you know, meaning prior to the European invasion. So there was some native activity, but it was pretty minor in terms of most of these forests. They were hugging along the coast, eating salmon and things like that. So they weren't doing a lot of burning or things like that, as they may in other forests. And so a Douglas fir here would grow up, and in likelihood, if it reached maturity, it would then live hundreds and hundreds of years. And occasionally there were fires. It would have a dry summer, a drought summer, and then dry wind, usually coming from the east. And if there was a source of ignition, there would be a stand replacing fire. But otherwise, these old growth forests lasted hundreds of years, and they were mostly old growth forests. But today, most Douglas firs don't live past 40 years of age. There's a forest on an island in the coast of Southwest Washington that hasn't burned in thousands of years. Now, the individual trees aren't that old, but the forest has not been disturbed by a hurricane or fire or logging in several thousand years. So you have layers of old growth trees, different layers in the canopy, and different species. Hemlock old growth comes in after Douglas fir, because hemlock is a shade tolerant species, so it lives under the Douglas fir stand. And as those Douglas firs die out and fall over, the hemlock can become dominant. So the general forest type is called Douglas fir western hemlock, but it's mostly Douglas fir, because after several hundred years, there will be a fire and sets back the natural ecological succession, or I should say resets, not set back, the natural ecological succession to what's called a complex early seral forest, which is a forest that the wind blew it down or the fire burned it up, but it didn't burn every tree. And unlike logging, all the boles of the trees didn't go to the mill. So you have this legacy of a burn stand with wildflowers and shrubs underneath, and legacy old growth trees, which are standing or fallen or living or dead, all combinations thereof. And that is a very rich in terms of biological diversity, in terms of species diversity and functional diversity and all the kinds.
So last summer, there was a pretty big fire northeast. I live in Crescent City, California, and there was a big fire up in the canyon between here and Grants Pass. And people were talking about it was big enough that it burned out some of those big high tension power lines. Anyway, there were people going, oh, ecological disaster. And I drove through soon after, and I was literally shouting in the car, this is what a burned forest is supposed to look like. Because it was patches. There would be, I don't know, a couple acres dead, and then a couple acres that were fine, and then a couple acres with a few dead trees. And it was a mosaic, is the term we always hear. And it was, frankly, pretty beautiful.
Well, you make it sound like a dead tree is a bad thing. There's more life in a dead tree than a live tree because it's decomposing and little organisms are in there bringing the wood back to soil eventually. And it's there's all kinds of cavity nesting birds and things like that. So there's a lot of life going on in the dead tree. You know, we've all been conditioned by Smokey the Bear, who needs to be there needs to be a hit out on Smokey the Bear. You know, he's if I say to you two words, a 99% chance you can finish it. And I say only you will say can prevent forest fires. You know, we have all been conditioned by the Advertising Council and Smokey the Bear, which is a kind of a registered trademark of the United States Forest Service. And you know, they all fires are bad. Well, they're not. And the Forest Service is getting better. They're rational about fire, oh, 9 months of the year. But 3 months of the year during fire season, they're totally irrational. They go nuts thinking they can put out fires. Well, you know, mostly they waste their time and cause environmental damage by putting bulldozer tracks through the woods and spraying chemicals to try to suppress the oxygen in the fire and things like that. And it doesn't work. I've long wanted to figure out how to sue the Forest Service because they've never done an environmental impact statement on their firefighting program. And under the National Environmental Policy Act, one has a requirement to have a reasonable range of alternatives. And I would argue one alternative that should be considered is simply pouring dollar bills out of large airplanes directly onto the fire. It probably would do a better job of smothering the fire. It would cause less environmental damage because people would go out and pick up the dollar bills that didn't burn up. And it would be cheaper for the taxpayer. So we are conditioned. The Forest Service will schedule retardant drops for the 5 o'clock news feed in Los Angeles. They do all kinds of stuff. It's really becoming the fire service. And so we as a society need to get over the fact that fire is bad. It's bad in your house, it's bad in town, but it's not bad in the backcountry. That's where they've always been fires. And a fire is either the continuation or the rebirth of a forest. And if, you know, they're actually are a necessity and they are desirable. So one of the big challenges of the conservation community is getting to the point where they stand up and say, and when the fires are going and the news stories are happening, they say, boy, that's a good fire. But, and we need to direct people's attention to, if you want to stop your house from burning down, you have to prepare the vegetation around your house within 100 feet, and you have to have a metal roof or a composition asphalt roof, and you have to have double pane windows, and you have to not have wood siding, and you do a few other things. In all likelihood, your house is not going to burn. But instead, we taxpayers are spending hundreds of millions of dollars to, in the name of preventing fires that could be easily prevented if people were responsible when they live near the woods.
So let's go back. Thank you for that. And let's go back to the region you were talking about. And can you've mentioned Doug firs and you've mentioned salmon, but can you provide a real introduction to the forest to somebody who may live in Kentucky or may not know what the coastal range forest is like in the region? You know, I've interviewed people about you know, the forests of eastern Ohio, and those are obviously different forests than forests out here. So can you help people to, from a distance, insofar as it's possible, fall in love with that region?
I'll try. I never met an ecosystem, and especially a forest I didn't like. But you know, the forests here I'm partial to, but they are, it's the size, the height of the canopy. They're taller than other forests. There are several 10, 5, 20 very, very large old growth trees per acre. Trees that might reach well over 250 feet in height that are at their base, that the width of them is can be 10 or 12 feet in diameter. And mostly Douglas fir, but also Western red cedar or Western hemlock. Western red cedar is closer to when the stream's a little wetter site, it will be more dominant. You also have Sitka spruce. So if there's a fog zone where the fog often lays in from the coast and moves its way up the river valleys, you're going to see old growth Sitka spruce. And so these forests are not as diverse in terms of the number of species as many forests in the eastern part of the United States, but they're huge. And that's the thing that I keep coming away with is they're simply their size and they're magnificent. You look up, you can see daylight, but it's a pretty thick canopy cover on a real old growth forest. And when you walk in on a summer day, they'll be 20, 25 degrees cooler, just simply because you're in the shade, and that rotten wood on the ground retains moisture, so it just has a very cooling effect on you, the visitor.
So you talked about how the restoration of these lands, or the turning of these lands back into the forests that they're supposed to be in, they once were, would be good for, and you named three species, spotted owl, marbled murrelet, and salmon generically. And can you get explicit about how it helps each one of those? Why do they need old growth, or why do they need these mature forests?
The spotted owl co-evolved with these old growth forests, so it requires old growth. They like the covered canopy and the open areas under the on the floor for prey, squirrels and voles and things like that, and they nest in old growth forests. You won't find them nesting in young forests. The tree structure is not, has to be diverse, similarly diverse, big. You'd have to have places for the spotted owl to nest, and you don't find that in a plantation tree. Let me give you a more specific example. The marbled murrelet, also, it's a seabird that you often see if you know what your birds are, and I've been told reliably by people who do, you'll see them kind of in little groups just beyond the surf, you know, off the Pacific coast, and they'll be out there, and they will dive. They can dive hundreds of feet, this little robin-sized bird, to get prey. And then they fly. The mother and the father take shifts on the nest and they fly back to the nest. Where's the nest? Up to 50 miles inland in an old growth forest, hundreds of feet above. And when a tree gets really old and tall, it usually has its top go away from a Christmas tree top to a scraggly broken top because it may have been hit by lightning, or it can't simply pull the moisture up anymore, and the tree gets weak and then it breaks off. And so you'll have these limbs that are 8, 12, 16 inches that are lateral branches that are moss covered. And then those murrelets nest in that moss. And mom is there for one shift, and the father comes back and regurgitates some fish that they made, and the other one goes off. And marbled murrelets are an incredible species that really jumps biome. Can you say, is it a forest species? Is it a seabird? Well, it's both. Salmon need clean water, lots of it, and they need diverse habitat. And so underappreciated value of salmon production has been the complex habitat in the stream created by what scientists will call large woody debris. In other words, those big trees falling into the stream slow the flow of water, create pools better habitat for various kinds of salmon. And then in the North Oregon Coast Range, you know, we had and have parts of small runs of coho salmon, steelhead, chinook, chum, or dog salmon, sockeye, where there are certain lakes in Washington, for example. And so these salmon adapted to various parts. Some returned from the ocean to spawn very high in the watershed, very high in tributary streams. Others, like fall chinook, they spawn in the main stem of the larger streams, the lower gradient. So every fish, salmon stock, had a niche. And remember, these are born in fresh water and they migrate to the sea, and then they come back after several years, and they have to come back, and they come back to generally the same place, but the habitat has to be there for them to have left, but also for them to come back and to be successful. And there are several stocks of Pacific salmon that are on the endangered species list that you can't blame on dams. You can blame on fishing too much, and you can blame it mainly on habitat destruction by logging the crap out of these watersheds.
You know, I don't know where you might want to take this, but my mom and I lived in Spokane back in the 90s, and she was sick of winter, so we wanted to move somewhere where there wasn't snow, and we considered Oregon. And honestly, the number one reason that we didn't move to Oregon was because there were so many clear cuts, and this is even back in the 90s. It's just, I know so many people who, yeah, there's clear cuts everywhere, but Oregon has been, to use your word, and it's a word I use all the time too, hammered. Oregon's been pretty hammered by logging.
You know, there's a couple reasons for that. One is there were just a lot of big trees here. There's money to be made. And the other is Oregonians never really cared much about scenic buffers. You know, the timber industry, I think, was so arrogant, they wouldn't even pretend. And so there was lots of efforts, and some of the early redwood conservation efforts were at least to conserve the scenery along a road, so you didn't see a redwood clear cut. So you have a benefit that some logging is hidden, that if you stop the first road that goes off from the highway and you drive a few yards, you will find that the scenic buffer is pretty thin. Just before the spotted owl hit the fan, meaning it became a political issue and a legal issue, and there were several court injunctions that stopped logging of old growth forest, we were in Oregon alone clear cutting 3 square miles each week of old growth forest. I've done the numbers. It's staggering. It was staggering. And so, you know, our peculiar institution, we just cut old growth forest. That's what we did. And thought they'd never run out. Well, it turns out the timber industry wasn't up against an owl, but they're up against an ocean. You know, they came and they cut, and eventually they ran out. And the argument about spotted owls precipitated a social debate that didn't happen on the East Coast, because the debate over the last of the forest happened while there still was the last of the forest. Where in the East, you know, they just cut it all. And when you go there in Pennsylvania, you'll see these little slivers of old growth forest or virgin forest. And you're going, why are they there? Why did this not get logged? Everything else did. Slivers, you know, a few acres. And it turns out it was mainly due to bad surveying. Surveyors got paid by the corner that the monument that they put in, and so they were fast and they often drunk and they did lousy work. And so you had a landowner who thought the other guy owned the land, that piece, and that other guy thought you owned that piece, so you never logged it because you both didn't think you owned that piece. And then the logging went through and the piece was a relic. So the old growth in the East that's left was mainly accident. We had a debate, and continue to have a debate. And it's increasingly a national debate with the Biden administration, as the president has issued an executive order that he wants to save all the mature and old growth forests that's left. The challenge will be getting the Bureau of Land Management and the Forest Service to actually do it. But we had a debate and we decided, no, we're not going to cut the last down. And we didn't. We're still fighting over old-growth logging at a much reduced level, but it's because it's so rare, any old-growth logging is unacceptable.
Well, let's thank you for that. And let's go back to the notion of the national park. And you talked about how it would be, this particular notion would be a combination of state lands and some private lands. So when you say private in this case, are you meaning corporate or are you meaning mom and dad and their two little children sitting in a house?
Corporate, large industrial landowners. The most timberlands in the United States are actually owned by small owners, small family-owned parcels. People own a piece of forest, and they don't log it as intensively as it could if they were in profit maximization mode. But there's a large amount of our private timberlands are truly, industrial tree farms. And to maximize the profit, that get the value out of that stand again and again, hammer it repeatedly. And so these lands that I'm talking about are mainly industrial lands. Very few people are living out there, not zero, but approaching that. And so these are vast amounts of the North Oregon Coast Range that have been heavily hammered, that have some wonderful relic mature and old growth forests and recovering forests, but it has very few people involved.
So let's pretend that this land was acquired. And this is a discussion that I've had with Michael Kellett many times. And he and I both are very strong advocates for generally, nearly always, but not always, the best thing to do to help a forest recover is nothing. So let's pretend that this land was acquired tomorrow and becomes a national park. And let's pretend you were the czar, not of andykerr.net, but the czar of this particular land. What would you do to help it recover? Would you mainly be hands off, or would you want to do some? What would you do? What would you do for the land? How would you see? And here's the real question. Give us a vision of that land starting to recover.
Okay. The it may be it's counterintuitive. I mean, in many cases, many times it's simply if you stop the ecological irritant, whether you're cow bombing it with livestock grazing, or whether you're mining a stream for gravel, or whether you're logging a forest, just stop doing that. Stop roading it. Stop having off-road vehicles, things like that. Nature has great capacity to recover in the most cases. And but there I think there is an ecological case to be made that when you have these monoculture plantations, that some judicious, scientifically sound and restrained thinning of those stands, not thinning so the remaining trees grow bigger so they can be better logs at the mill, but thinning to open up the stand a little bit because they're very dense. They're touching each other. There's the canopy is, it's not a canopy as much as they're all rubbing shoulders and in a plantation. And so ecologically, and this happened on the Sisal National Forest when there were a lot of plantations, but it's now all essentially all late successional reserves under the Northwest Forest Plan. And what the Forest Service had done with the blessing of most of the conservation community has gone in. Thin these plantations once. Thin them. Sometimes they plant some maple trees and cedar trees to increase the species diversity because when the monoculture was successful, there's just Douglas fir left. But they open it up and they go, and so it opens up and you allow some sunlight into the floor, and that helps accelerate or re-accelerate the onset of late successional or older forest characteristics again. So, but you do it once, and then as you leave, you pull the roads out. You don't maintain the roads forever. You then put water bars on the road to make those roads hydrologically invisible to the watershed. and you're out. And then you let nature go. And it's going to take hundreds of years till they're truly natural forests again. But thinning these plantations, I don't have a problem with. Some of my friends will go, well, what if they thin too much? And I go, it's a plantation. It's like a cornfield. So if you thin it too much, it's not the worst thing for you. You still opened it up. You still made it more biologically diverse and put it on a path to become more resilient and more a natural forest over time. So in that case, in many cases of other forest types, yeah, you don't need to do anything. Just let it go. On the East Coast, there's nothing that needs to be done. In the drier forests of the Mountain West, there's an argument to be made for thinning some of the smaller trees so as to protect the older trees, which are threatened somewhat by fire because of ladder fuels and stuff that are unnatural, but mainly because those younger trees are out competing because of fire suppression, are out competing those older trees. And so those old growth trees are dying out, even with the absence of fire, due to moisture stress and competition. So you want to sometimes favor those relic old growth ponderosa pine or similar species. So it is a little bit ironic in life, but life is ironic that a little bit of logging may be helpful to make these forests real again.
So let's go through the well, I'm going to say something and then ask for that vision again. And then the thing I'm going to say is that in 1989, I think it was, I interviewed Dick Manning after he wrote the book The Last Stand, and I threw out this line that was, "Wouldn't it be great to set some land aside and wait 200 years and you have old growth?" And he said, "Derek, in 200 years, you have not gone through one quarter of the way through one carbon cycle. That the Doug fir has to grow up and become old, and then it has to fall over, and then it in some of these forests can take decades or longer for that." Oh, and then one more story about that, which is George Wirtner told me this great story about how a few years ago he was in Yellowstone and there was a basically bumper crop of a certain sort of ant that was being eaten by the grizzlies. And he said that this ant was doing so well this year because of the Great Yellowstone Fire 30 years ago, that the trees had gotten to the right point in the decomposition for that ant to just go crazy on them. And so, 30 years ago there was a fire, however many years ago, and now we've got fat grizzlies. And so the thing that Dick Manning made clear to me there is just forests seem to go on a different sense of time than we might sometimes think, in terms of, it can take a long time to grow. That's why I made the sort of joke about, oh, do Doug firs normally live 60 years? Because there's, I see redwoods. I live near redwoods, and if you have, they can grow up from the base again. You can have a 2,000-year-old trunk or a 1,500-year-old trunk, but if there's a couple of them growing right next to each other, those roots might be 3,000 years old because it fell over and then grew up, sprouted again from that. I'll shut up now. Just forests have a different, seem to have a different sense of time to me.
They do because we humans, the most we can do is live 80, 70, 80 years on the whole. And that to a Douglas fir forest that is managed to maximize the volume of timber. That's what the Forest Service used to do, as opposed to the volume of timber over time, as opposed to the mill, the volume of the timber over time to the mill versus timber industry. It's the maximum value, which is a function. There is a time value to money, so they're in a rush. And so a tree is a Douglas fir tree is just starting to, quote, become mature at 70 or 80 years old when we're about to die out ourselves. And and then you have the benefit of living near redwoods, which are very long-lived trees, some of the longest-lived trees in the world. But forests are older than any tree. So even if a forest burns, it's still a forest. It's a continuation of, but from our short time frame that we are here as individuals on Earth, we look at it and go, oh, it used to be a wonderful mature old growth forest, and now it burns, so it's not the same. And I've had some conservationists just go, well, I don't care now. They can log it. I don't care because it's not the same. And a very superficial, shall we say, shallow view of the world. And so we need to think about forests, but we need to think of all of our ecosystems in longer time frames than we allow ourselves in the West to primarily do. And we simply need to give nature time so we may reap her benefits. And we globally as a society, as opposed to certain corporations maximizing profit over the short term.
So again, realist, you, the land becomes a national park tomorrow. Give us what does a snapshot of the area look like in 50 years, 100, 150? How long do you think it would take? This is a real question, not just an interview question. Presuming that salmon don't go extinct from overfishing or from the murder of the oceans or anything else. How long would it take for habitat on a stream that's pretty hammered? How long would that take for that to start becoming decent and then good salmon habitat again?
It's somewhat relative in that the recovery starts immediately. So it isn't like we have to have a endurance of 100 years where it's just hell, continues to be hell out there. It's going to be improving. When you re stop the ecological irritation, that helps nature recover a lot. And so it just gets better. It builds resilience and volume. So the forests get bigger and they get older. And in my mind, they get prettier. And so, from a purely aesthetic standpoint, because I look at old trees and I see there's an aesthetic appreciation I have for old trees. And so it happens over time. So, will it be worth doing to society? Well, yeah, it's worth doing from year one. It's more worth doing from year 10, year 100, year 1000. We'll appreciate it. Or at least our successors will, if we have any. That's a bigger issue. And so, recovery can be fast. Now, to get back the carbon, so it's those massive carbon stores, you got to have massive old forests. That's going to take hundreds of years. But every year, you're taking excess carbon out of the air and out of the atmosphere and putting it back in the biosphere where it needs to be.
So how we have about 5 minutes left, and can you talk about how we can start to move this from a notion to a plan, to a organization, to a campaign, in whatever order those go?
Well, the first is people have to have the vision to see it. There are conservation organizations working on the conservation of the elevating the conservation status of these lands. There's a the Board of Forestry in Oregon is meeting today to maybe adopt a forest management plan that complies with the Endangered Species Act that will result in a lot less logging in the future than has happened in the past, including the designation of conservation reserves, but not all of it. And so there's a tension. What's the highest and best use of these forests is a debate we're having. Well, I think the highest and best use of these forests is for carbon sequestration and salmon production, just to name two things. Timber is the most common use of forests, but we can get our fiber from mainly farmlands through crop waste and growing hemp and flax. We can make our construction products, our paper products. We don't need to be cutting down hundreds of year old trees to make toilet paper or what have you. So, how do you get that to happen? How did Yosemite National Park happen? It was some people discovered it. John Muir learned about it. He started an organization, and it goes. So I don't have a roadmap other than a general path is first start talking about it, getting people excited about it, draw lines on a map, gather public support. You know, any national park that was created has had, almost, I'm hesitating on using the word local support, hyper-local support. Most people have opposed national park creation, that are those who were the very closest to it. But Oregon made a national park at Crater Lake in 1902, and there was a lot of support for it in Portland, but there wasn't much support in Klamath County. Hell, it's still a touch-and-go thing in Klamath County, depending on who you're talking to. So whether Crater Lake is a good idea or not as a national park. So it's like any conservation campaign, it's organizing, it's network, it's pushing, it's pressure, political pressure, and all of that. The challenge in the 21st century is a challenge of time and scale. We don't have a lot of time. And the scale of the problem is we need to be making big parks, big carbon reserves, big nature reserves, and preserving what we have left, but also allowing nature to reestablish much that has been lost. And so is this one, you know, are people going to get excited about this park notion? I hope so. I believe they will, but it's going to take some time, which means don't wait, but it means start now.
So when another interview I was having with Michael Kell again was about a park that was proposed in New Jersey, and one of the arguments he was making for it, and you know, tourism's not my favorite thing. My favorite thing is always biodiversity, but he was still arguing that a good reason to make that park is because there's a huge population in New York City, and this would be a chance to see some wild nature within an hour's drive. And so again, I'm not a huge fan of tourism, but would the park that you're proposing be relatively close enough to Portland for people to do a day
oh,
trip?
Yeah, very, very close to Portland. And you know, the problem is it's salvation, and probably the greatest threat would be that it'd be too close to Portland. You know, we just have too many people on the earth. I know it's not politically correct to say that, but we do. And so we get crowded. So one way to address the supply problem of nature from a recreation standpoint is to create more protected areas. The other is we should have less people over time than we do now. And so, you know, that argument of part of a coalition that has made every national park has been those who see it in terms of dollars for tourism or economic development. You know, you look at Yosemite Park, and you go into Yosemite Valley on a peak summer day, and you don't want to be there. There's just so damn many people, and it's just crowded and noisy and polluted. But if you go a few hundred feet off the trail, where most people don't, you know, that's some of the wildest land in California. And it's protected as a national park, and nature has her own way there. And so it's a trade-off. But, you know, is it better to make money? If money must be made off of forests, it's better to make it off of selling the carbon into a carbon market to help the climate than selling the wood to a mill to make a few jobs and some people, a few people, a lot of money. So is it better to have areas that are touristed, but the forest is still standing? Yeah, I think it is. It's a trade-off. I know part of me doesn't want it to happen, but I don't want the industrialization to continue either.
Well, thank you for all that. And thank you for having this notion and for promoting it. And thank you for your work in the world. And thank you for being on the program. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Andy Kerr. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.